Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode number 348, recorded Friday, May 25th, 2018. John Unterkoffler. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we talk to some of the biggest names in tech, the big thinkers, the people doing the interesting stuff, and we get to spend some time finding out why they do it and where they came from. And today I am thrilled to get to talk to John Unterkoffler. He is the CEO of Oblong Industries. That's a team of designers, programmers, and hardware engineers applying human-centered design principles to technology development. He's also been the science advisor on several films, including Minority Report, Iron Man, and the Ang Lee version of The Hulk. John's current work comes out of his 15 years at the MIT Media Lab. Thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start just with the tech that you first fell in love with, because I like to ask that of people that have been that do amazing things that were kind of the first in their field in a lot, and that's what I think of a lot of your work is. So what was the first tech that inspired you?
The first thing that pops to mind, it may not be actually temporarily the first, but the first thing that pops to mind is a person, actually. My uncle had a friend named Doug Crompton, has a friend named Doug Crompton, who was and is a ham. I don't know if it's divulging too much to reveal his call letters, but I still remember them. And he, like many hams in the day, was sort of a walking Radio Shack, in a sense, and had built computers and transponders and all this stuff. So it wasn't just the radio piece. It was just a very broad kind of 360 view of technology. And it was all DIY necessarily at the time. And I just thought, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in this little attic, and I'd like to live here. later on, that impulse got crystallized when my family got an Apple II Plus. I think it was probably 1979. And of course, the great thing there is that if you don't program it, not a lot is going to happen, because it doesn't come loaded with any software except for a programming language or two. And so that really was the beginning. I'd had a couple of brushes with computers, but of course that's the big thing about the personal computer, is that you can be in contact with it, irresponsibly much if your interests go in that direction. I lived in Pennsylvania, and every once in a while we'd go across into New Jersey, Barrington, New Jersey, to Edmund Scientific, which was an amazing kind of warehouse. They're still in business; they have a great catalog, but I think, in some sense, the view of technology back then there's no question that the view of technology was far less curated, and therefore, in a way, also, I think, less blinded. Mm-hmm. And so everything was sort of on the table, whether it was optics or rocketry, and you didn't have to sort of specialize in your own mind, in your own psychology as much. I don't know what I'm revealing about myself here, but
so did you ever get a ham license of your own?
I didn't, and that's like one of those things where in 40 or 50 years, am I going to be drawing last breath going, I wish I'd studied Morse code more, I should mm-hmm. have that license. But
well, you still could.
It's
not too late.
I have 40 or 50 years. Yes. Or 4 or 5 minutes. We don't know.
So in 1984, you went to MIT.
Yes.
So you started there and you almost never left. You spent the entire 90s there.
Don't remind my parents, please.
So you were there as the MIT Media Lab was just beginning. And yeah, there's so much stuff that has come out of the Media Lab over the years and still continues to come out. I love to talk to people who have worked there. So what was it like in the beginnings?
It was by design a kind of grab bag, a really uncomfortable assembly of people and disciplines and ideas and equipment, literally like weird equipment just sitting around that different people thought might become useful along the way. But the brilliance of the place, and this was really Nicholas Negroponte's insight in founding it, is that it wasn't a computer science lab, because here's Negroponte saying, hold on a minute, computers, yeah, we know that we've got them now, and they're great for data processing, and your spreadsheet runs on it, and there's some databases and stuff like that, but that's not what computers are really for. That's not what they will become. And his single giant and incredibly prescient message was, computers are for communication, they're for human communication. And so that really was the through line that animated most of the stuff that we did at the Media Lab. But to prove out that point, he populated his brand new lab not just with computer scientists, but also with documentary filmmakers and roboticists and holographers, one of which I was for 8 years, and computer graphics people and composers and fanatics of all different stripes and lots of other people besides. And it was the deliberate collision, high-velocity collision of these people in the bubble chamber of the Media Lab that sent out these spirals and let us discover new particles in the form of new technologies, new ideas, new companies, lots of new ways to fight with your colleagues, of course, as well. So
you were a holographer.
I was. I'm a lapsed holographer now.
So how did you get involved in that? Like, were you a big Star Trek fan, or what? It sparked your interest in holography.
Right, well, so by that time, by 1984, of course, we all had fixed in our minds the image of Princess Leia coming, you know, out of one or the other of R2-D2's little optical nozzles, and the suggestion, the powerful suggestion that we could have real-time kind of dynamic holography. And I was lucky to sort of fall into the gravitational orbit of a guy named Stephen Benton, who was one of the two or three kind of preeminent figures in the admittedly esoteric world of holography. He had been a protege of Ed Land, the founder of Polaroid, as well as of Doc Edgerton, the inventor of the strobe. So there was this kind of highly visual strain that expressed itself really, really powerfully in Steve, and he was a charismatic guy, and I just immediately fell in love with optics and the idea, the sort of North Star that we could add a dimension to imaging and really communicate in three dimensions. At the time, it was all static holography, so you made holograms with lasers in dark basements late at night when the trains had stopped running, because everything floated on vibration isolation tables and the tolerances. And the diffraction fringe patterns are so fine that you're recording that the slightest disturbance will mess up your recording. Blah, 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 a whole lot of detail. But what was really exciting is that along the way, Steve realized that there might just be enough computing power and optical technology coming into being that we could build a real dynamic and electronic holographic display, which we did.
Wow, and that was in the Media Lab.
That was in the Media Lab, yes.
Wow. Yeah, I think of Star Trek as like the holodeck, but Star Wars, that was really
inspiring. Predated by a little bit,
yes.
Yeah. And I'm sure we can find other examples if we go even further back in sci-fi.
Wow. Well, it's interesting that you did work on Minority Report, which I think inspires so many technologists now. And it's always the language that people grasp. You know, well, it's like Minority Report.
Right.
Even as a tech journalist, I find myself saying
that.
Yeah,
I feel complexly about that, right? I feel compelled to apologize. Like, we're never going to be rid of it, right? Well, actually, there's the invitation is to supersede it with something, with the next better set of references. But until then, sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's just, yeah, I mean, I guess that was the same thing you were thinking about with Star Wars, just that if you could create the perfect hologram, then Princess Leia would appear.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that's
very true. Something, and there was something directly analogous. I haven't thought about this for a little while, but you know, as my responsibilities on the film were very far ranging, because the film is filled with future tech and it all had to kind of knit together into a coherent pattern that looked like a real future and not a kind of patchwork thing that had been scraped together at the last minute. But of course, the bulk of my work, at least for a big months long chunk, was on the kind of next gen UI, the gestural user interface that first Tom Cruise and then the Neil McDonough and Colin Farrell characters use. And I, you know, of course it was that work that had pulled me into the film in the first place, because it was kind of an extension of what I'd been doing at MIT. But I remember having a realization on one particular morning that here was an opportunity to do this kind of thing right. And what I had in mind was another Philip K. Dick adaptation, Blade Runner. And there's the scene in which, the Rick Deckard character, Harrison Ford, is sloshed. He's at home. He's got this holographic picture that's been recovered from the bureau drawer. And he sticks it in this little reader machine that's hooked up to his TV, like an old VCR. And he uses it to kind of navigate visually around corners and discover the snake scales in the tub that leads him to blah, blah, blah. But the, you know, as captivating as that moment is, you have no idea what he's doing, right? It's voice activated. He's saying, you know, enhance 14 to 37. And it sounds great, but at no point as a viewer, even someone highly motivated, can you click in and say, ah, okay, I see what's going on. It's just simply cool. And I remember thinking, we can do this so that people understand it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So let's get back to your time at MIT. You finished your undergrad degree, and then you went right into a graduate degree. And what was your first study there in your, like, after undergrad?
I just sort of rolled right on into more holography. So
your undergraduate was in holography.
Yeah, the way that MIT is or was at the time set up, my undergraduate degree is in electrical engineering, because that's where MIT keeps the optics nerds. Mm-hmm. And that was as close as one could get to holography at the time. And at that time, and I think still, the Media Lab didn't have an undergraduate degree or program. I'm not sure if that's true. Anyway, so then rolling into the master's program, it was media, arts, and sciences as a formal field of study.
And so were you interacting with filmmakers in the Media Lab at that point? Like, were there people wanting to, bend your ear about holograms and the films they were working on?
No, because the components that came into the Media Lab were, of course, Ricky Leacock, who is one of the several fathers of cinema verite, the kind of, you know, fly-on-the-wall style of documentary filmmaking, and Gloriana Davenport. The two of them had put together the Interactive Cinema Group. But the IC group had had a number of lapsed filmmakers as students in it, chief among them probably in my own kind of orbit, Alan Lasky, who had spent a bunch of time as a camera person and visual effects person. So there was a strong set of a bunch of thinking about cinema, but no one yet asking for holography to go back into cinema. So that would take a little bit longer.
Oh.
But the sort of cinema as inspiration for UI is a big theme for me, and that's partly why I bring it up. I think that's, you know, we need more references as we think about designing new UI, and old UI is not one of them.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, because the general UI took so long to even represent it accurately on film. And now, you know, it's always seems to be a little behind on most. I mean, most, unless it's really researched. Oh, so let's talk about The Luminous Room. Was that your first graduate degree, or was that?
That was the last one, thank goodness.
That was a PhD.
Yes. Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about that. I think we have some video of some of your work. There's a chessboard that I just find fascinating. Tell us a little bit about what the Luminous Room was and what you were studying.
Yeah, well, by 1994, I'd gotten, I think, frankly, a little bit frustrated just that we couldn't move faster in developing electronic holography. We all wanted it to be huge and real-time and full-color and completely interactive, but the fact is that the technology, the information density, was just too much. It was too hard to get done, and I was just itching to make things move and make things be responsive. And so by 1994, it started to occur to me that, well, you know, we've had 10 years of this Macintosh UI, right? And by then, it all looked like that. Windows, Apple's products, Linux didn't quite exist yet. But, you know, that was the UI. And naively, I thought, well, 10 years, that's a good run for a UI. Let's build the next one. What should the next one be? The machines are faster. We can do things with cameras. We have all these opportunities. What would the next UI be? And it seemed to me that it would, the direction to go would be in a much more human direction, a much more architectural direction. Let's set ourselves free from the tyranny of the rectangle of pixels. And that literally was the thought. Let's smash open the CRT in those days. It would have been a flat panel today, but let's smash open the CRT and let the pixels go everywhere in the room. And what happens if you do that, right? It's one thing to say that, all right, we have pixels everywhere in the room and we've got cameras looking into the room to try to make sense of it. But the real work, I think, to bear out that idea, the real work is to build systems, build actual working systems that look like they might be useful, that look like they might do something interesting with this kind of core facility that you've imagined. So that was the beginning of the Luminous Room, and the task really was to build out a bunch of examples that would show, you know, in as general a way as possible, what it would be like if at least one of your UIs could do this kind of thing, if the UI were in the room with you.
And so did you, we're looking at, what are we looking at here, this video?
That's a fluid flow simulation. By that time, it was easy enough to do small regions of fluid flowing around. But the kind of insight there was, well, we could let the machine make the pixels that represent the simulation, but we could take physical objects from the real world and stick them in the simulation as if you were placing a real object in a real wind tunnel. So the idea of merging together physical artifacts and a purely digital surface or a digital space seemed very, very powerful. Here, I assume this is going out live as we speak.
Yes.
So, you know, in this example, which is more about architecture and urban planning, the idea was to invert what by that time was the dominant paradigm, which was CAD, which is, you know, all of these very, very sad architects staring into ugly beige displays and trying to do this spatial 3D rich thing in 2D with a mouse. So instead, what happens if you let architects and urban planners have direct access to models, the same thing that made architecture go for the 2,000 or 3,000 years previously? If you do that and ask the machine to work a little harder and find the buildings and project down shadows and, you know, inject wind simulations into that little space that you're setting up, and basically let you ask questions in the spatial domain, which is where architecture takes place, and have the answers come back into that same space. That was the proposition there. And the result was really compelling. It was fun.
So when I first look at it, I think, oh, well, it looks like AR, augmented reality. But it's not. It's something slightly different.
We're getting into this murky zone where the exact definitions of AR, I think, are blurrier than maybe once they were. I think it would have been fair to call that augmented reality because the emphasis was on the reality there, not on squinting through a display. In fact, there was no headgear. There was nothing you had to wear. I think part of the visceral feeling of those systems was that it was just there in the room, like the rest of the room.
Right.
And the pixels could follow you around and they could follow your artifacts around. And there was no tech mediation between you and your hands and your eyes and the human visual system and the stuff you cared about.
And it's all in the room with you is kind of a theme in your work. It's, you know, everyone's experiencing it. I mean, because I don't necessarily, you know, the big thing about AR on the iPhone, let's say, is that, well, you don't have to wear goggles. But it's still something that I'm experiencing alone, really. I mean, unless you're sitting over my shoulder looking at it with me, but it's not the same experience. But what you're seeing there really is everyone in the room can interact with it. Everyone sees it, and it's more of a collaborative experience.
That's exactly right. And that's why, instead of doing this over Skype, I came here, because you want to hear to the Twitch studios thousands of miles beneath the Earth's crust in the secret bunker, because we're face to face, right?
Right.
You want the highest bandwidth, highest fidelity connection possible between whatever it is, hopefully a lot of humans, and also in some cases data or interaction that you can get. So that kind of high bandwidth proximal interaction is really important. And the kind of basic human, social, and cognitive thing that we do where we understand something by being together and looking at the same thing at the same time is hugely powerful. And it's kind of a loss or a miss on the part of technology that most tech hasn't figured that out yet. It's still tech is for one person at a time. Whereas, you know, what would it be like if tech were for a team of people at the same time? What if it intended to serve groups of people in the same way that current tech is kind of fixated on serving individual people. And that's what I do for a living now.
Well, I think about that that sort of shared experience that you're talking about. That was 1994. Mm-hmm. And so we can agree, and I assume other people would agree, that that would be more ideal than wearing a giant headset or having something on an individual screen. And I think, you know, specifically of like HoloLens, when it was promised in 2015, early 2015, you know, it was, well, you can play Minecraft on this, you know, on your table, and that would be great. But it's a giant headset. It hasn't really come yet. And it isn't, I mean, it isn't two people experiencing it necessarily in the same room. Why not? Like, what's holding us back from that? Like, why can't we do that? What's the tech that we don't have?
I think there's no tech that we don't have, and there are a few experiences in HoloLens and other devices that actually do attempt to place you in a more kind of aggregate setting where there are representations of other people. But that's the thing. Like, if you're inside some technology, then you have to basically reinvent interaction, like human-to-human interaction. You have to reinvent what eye contact means. You have to reinvent, less so with AR, obviously, if you're looking through a transparent, you know, head-mounted display, but certainly in VR. I think what's holding us back is therefore not tech, it's just will. It's the recognition that that would be one of the most powerful things we could do, is to bring people closer to each other rather than to, in addition to bringing them closer to tech worlds or invented worlds that they certainly can't get at any other way. It's early. It's early. And, you know, we just haven't figured out what AR and VR is really, really great for yet. Mm-hmm. And we will.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think about that, you know, FaceTime or Skype, they're perfectly good ways of communicating with people. And yet most people choose not to use them most of the time unless they have to.
If you have a choice.
Yeah, if you have a choice. People are just, so it's almost like we are moving, I mean, do you think we're moving as a species more towards not preferring eye contact?
I worry a lot about the exact kind of thing you're describing, the imposition of tech that hasn't perhaps thought through all of its consequences and is going after one goal, which may be entirely laudable, but ends up removing maybe critical cues. And the thing, you know, the sort of super acute example that's always in the back of my head or the front of my head is telephony, right? I mean, I'm old enough to remember landlines when they were actually landlines and there was no, you know, internet in between. It was just copper wire. Mm-hmm. And so you're going not quite at the speed of light, but you're going as fast as the signal can travel. And there's, you know, the conversations that you have with someone that you're talking to in real time are essentially unmediated. It's not that different from being in a single room. And I remember when cell phones first became prevalent, the additional latency, the lag, just completely skewed every conversation I attempted to have. Like, you end up over-talking and then backing off and all that stuff. And it hasn't really improved.
Mm-hmm. I would say it's getting worse because we talk on the phones so much less.
Well, that's right. Yeah, you do everything with your phone, but use it as a phone. Mm-hmm. Like, that's sort of the last function that it has. And so, yeah, I don't know. What does it mean that that is not one of the metrics, that's not one of the criteria by which we measure this fundamental communications technology? And at Bell Labs, that was the job of dozens or hundreds or thousands of people to make sure that the signal got there as fast as it could with minimal latency and people could hear each other. Mm-hmm. Because all there was, I mean, there was a little tiny bit of tech that was very hard to do at the time, and then it was people.
Yeah. Okay, so you finished your PhD.
Sorry, was that too cranky?
No, you're actually one of the less cranky people I've talked to. So you finished your PhD, and was that when you were approached to work on Minority Report?
Yeah, it was one of those confluences that's just so ridiculous that it can only happen in the real world. I'd finished my dissertation some months before and was kind of tidying up and publishing and doing the things you do while you figure out the next step. And Minority Report at that point just got really and truly and finally and fully green lit. It had tried to get off the ground once or twice previously, once even with Spielberg, but this time it was going to happen for real. And one of the pre-production activities was that the film's production designer, an extraordinary guy named Alex McDowell, was flying around the country, basically visiting as many industrial labs and universities as he could, looking for advanced technology, sort of tech just on the cusp that would be both recognizable today, sort of, and could clearly extrapolate into the future with which to populate this world. Because Spielberg's brief to him, probably terrifyingly, was this has to be a completely real world. I don't want it to feel like sci-fi. I want it to feel like this is just what you get if you wait around 50 years and drive to Washington, D.C. It looks like this. So, wow, what a long segue and intro. So there's Alex and the prop master, Jerry Moss, stopping by the Media Lab. And I just sort of got into this hours-long discussion with him. And he looked at the Luminous Room stuff. And at some point he said, yeah, I think this set of ideas probably solves one of our hardest design problems on Minority Report, which is Stephen wants to know what computers are going to look like. How do we operate them in 50 years?
So it was 2025, is that the year it takes place?
2054.
2050.
As it hits the streets, but when we started, it was set in 2080, and there was a moment when Stephen said, it's just too far, we can't predict. And he's right, we can barely predict 2 years ahead at this point, and so he felt like 80 years was too much. We pulled it back to 2044, and then for some reason that I've never gotten a good answer to or never been able to figure out, right at the last minute, we went up by 10 years to 2054. Okay. So if you look really carefully, you can see a little bit of ADR or looping, putting different dates into actors' mouths to make the calendar math work out. So,
so they came to you and they wanted to see what computers looked like. So were you in charge of all of the technology, like the big advertising screens, and what about the cars and stuff?
Yeah, ultimately it was my job to make sure that all of the technology that would appear in the film knitted together, that it seemed to be, in fact, from a single, consistent, coherent future that you would get to by just waiting around for 50 years, as I said, and instead of being patched together. So that was a pretty broad charter. That didn't mean that I had to design everything, and a film is a village and takes a village, and there's lots and lots of insanely talented people involved, including a bunch of outside consultants on the film. But that kind of knit it together job was a big one, and often I was in the position of explaining how something would work. So the cars were designed by Harold Belker, but how would a car both drive on a horizontal surface and then drive up the side of a wall? Mm-hmm. Well, what you get to pretty quickly, and what I started unearthing and extrapolating, is maglev, right? It's a propulsion mm-hmm. technology that's been in development in Japan and Germany and a few other places for quite a while now. A non-contact thing that would have exactly those properties. And what's so exciting and fun about working that way, like, let's not just imagine the surface, but let's explain the tech all the way down, and let's intersect that tech explanation with political explanation and sociological and anthropological and political explanation and aesthetic explanation and advertising, which runs the whole Minority Report world. What you get are these tendrils that kind of interleave and have a lot of really fun, unexpected consequences that feel like the real world. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's worth going that deep.
So was there anything that you had got just from the Philip K. Dick story that wasn't from the script that you were given?
Not very much. I mean, if you go back and read the short story, which I did just a few years ago, there's not much there. It's very, very bare bones. And a lot of the characters are changed. The script itself went through so many iterations. Even the who ended up being the heavy in the end, the revelation about who'd been mucking with the system went through different transformations along the way. So there's the key piece from the script that remains is, of course, the idea of the three precogs, the psychic teenagers who, woe be to them, have to lie in a bath and dream of violent crime all day long. So that's basically it. There was a set of MacGuffins around punch cards, which were like the 1960s version of the hard copy / data or evidence from the analysis of the precogs that kind of transformed into the wooden balls in the film, but there wasn't a whole lot else other than names.
Well, and it's funny because I just recently rewatched it. Like, I don't know that I'd seen it since it came out, but I had totally forgotten the biology aspect of it, the precogs, that there's so much, you know, that there's, I think of it as a movie where like, oh yeah, so much of that has come true. But really it's, you know, what's come true is the sort of pre-crime and like using algorithms to be able to predict who's going to, you know, who you need to arrest, who you need to look after. And then just the fact, I mean, just the gesturing that we see a lot of. So what you've created really is what sticks with people. Just the screen that everyone remembers and moving things around. And we'll get to Oblong Industries, which is your business and how that relates to that. But I don't know, I've forgotten what my question was. Okay, and I wanted to ask about you had created, like, you created an entire sort of, it's not like you just created sets for this. This is an entire, basically, operating system, and you created a manual for it as well?
Yeah, I mean, I had to create and publish a bunch of artifacts that would train the actors, and not just the actors, but, give clues to the director and the people who are building props and costumes and the rest of it, how this system would work. And it went further, too. I mean, I'd never worked on a film before, so I was incredibly naive. I didn't know how anyone else would go about doing this, and so I did the only thing I knew how to do, which is to design the system somewhat painstakingly as if it would need to get built, right? As if the next step was going to be to actually implement this, because, you know, we'd been building stuff like it at MIT. And there was a moment when I had to decide whether to actually try to build it so it could work on set on the day as the cameras rolled, or let the visual effects people composite the stuff in later. And we went with choice B, which is a good idea, given the film context. But except for the fact that it wasn't implemented as running code, it was a very, very real system. It was a complete kind of domain-specific control language, gestural control language, assembled from bits and pieces of American Sign Language and, you know, SWAT team and police command stuff and ground air traffic control signals and a bunch of other stuff that is real and that humans use to communicate with each other. And then, you know, all that gets distilled down to kind of a dictionary or a thesaurus that's handed out to the team and the actors. And I ended up making a training video as well, just to so that people could watch and see what it would look like, which means that on the day when you're shooting those scenes, there's real intentionality. There's real causality there. The actors know what they're doing. They know why they're doing it. They know what they would be seeing on the screen, and they know what their characters will be looking at on the screen when the film comes out. And that dedication to verisimilitude, I think, is what finally kind of comes bursting through the other end.
Absolutely. I mean, and then, you know, just the fact that it stays with you stays with so many people. And it is the language that we grasp when we're trying to explain so many of this, like, the next UI.
Yeah, it's become a useful shorthand.
Yeah,
exactly. You never know, but it worked out in this case.
I want to talk about the other movies that you were an advisor on, and I want to talk about Oblong Industries, and I want to get your take on some of the new technologies that are out there, the VR, AR, and also what you think of some of the tech in current TV. But first, I have to take a second to thank our sponsor, and then you get a chance to take a sip of water and relax and run out of here if you need to. I will chase you, though, because I'm not done. I want to thank Rocket Mortgage for supporting this episode of Triangulation. If you've ever tried to get a mortgage the old-fashioned way, you've probably been frustrated. You have to leave the house, talk to a person, go through all your documents. It's annoying. And it's one of those things that we're talking about person-to-person, face-to-face communication, which is great, but not with all things. You know, have great conversations, but you don't necessarily have to have some great conversations with your mortgage broker. You can use technology to make the process easier in this case. And I'll tell you a little bit more about Rocket Mortgage. They will give you confidence. That's always helpful, confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home. It's super easy. You can understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. There's trusted partners. They allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button, and it's powerful. So if you're looking to buy your very first home or your 20th home, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. They'll look at your income, your assets, and your credit, and they can analyze all of the home loan options that you qualify for. and then find the one that is just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of triangulation. I am talking to Robert Underkoffer. He was the science advisor on Minority Report and several other movies, and he is the CEO and founder of Oblong Industries, which we will talk about. So, after Minority Report, what happened then? What did you work on then? Was it did you immediately continue working in films, or did you go back to try to get back into? No more school,
for heaven's sake. Yeah, I ended up working on a number of additional tech projects on the side, but what we'd done with Minority Report sort of resonated, I think, and I started getting calls for other films. The next one that I ended up on in a substantial way was Ang Lee's version of The Hulk.
Mm-hmm. My favorite version, I have to say.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably vastly underappreciated. There's a lot going on in it, certainly.
it's a little bit dark. You know, it's less superhero-y.
It is. Well, he's the glum superhero, right? Yeah. He's bummed out all the time, he's bummed out or pissed off all the time, and that's his character. And I think that tone is very consonant with Ang's own sensibility in his film. So it was kind of the right superhero for him to take a go at.
So what was the specific tech that you worked on in that?
Well, all of the characters in the core story are actually scientists, and the one who isn't is a science administrator, Betty Ross's dad, Thunderbolt Ross. And it turns out that Ang's wife is a microbiologist, and I had some sense that he told me directly that she she was very insistent that the science be authentic and accurate in the film. He wanted the kind of fantasy and superhero part to be a layer on top of, a substrate that was otherwise pretty believable, which was a lot of fun to work with. So I took all of the principal actors to spend a day at Caltech in the Mayo Lab, just sort of, palling around with people and processes that their characters would actually have to be familiar with in the movie. But the big question was how does the Hulk work? What is the explanation? And we've got the Bill Bixby version from TV in the 70s, and we've got the original comic book stuff, and we have a couple of key ideas, like the Hulk is green and not some other color, and out of that, what can you make? How can you explain a Hulk that also feels up to date? So we settled on a combination of nanotechnology and some other effects that all got woven into the film. But the most fun that came out of that is that at a certain point, the production decided that we had to explain the whole film and the Hulk origin in a kind of super dense credit sequence at the beginning of the film, which in fact is where I met my wife working on that title sequence. So that's, extra meaningful to me. But it was a blast, right? How do you distill down this kind of genetic Frankenstein tomfoolery that the Hulk's dad, David Banner, is undertaking that results accidentally in the creation of the Hulk? So it's kind of an updated Mary Shelley thing.
Yeah. And then you also worked on Jarvis in Iron Man, which is when that came out that we didn't have personal assistants in our house so much,
Not
right?
like that, yeah.
And now it's a big thing. Mm-hmm. So, you've foretold everything.
No. And again, it takes a lot of people to make a movie, so I can hardly take credit for most of what you see in
but
Iron Man and so forth.
But the physical manifestation of Jarvis, you were in charge of
that? The heads-up display when he's flying around in the suit, how would that work? Like, how does the UI work when you've got voice and you have gaze, right? You've got eye tracking, presumably. And it's a really fun problem when you get way down into the weeds with it. Like, you want stuff here, but you also want it to move out of the way. So there's a lot of kind of predictive and assistive, just geometric rearrangement that goes on if you go back and still frame and single frame advance through it. I think what's interesting about Iron Man is that, of course, he's the superhero who doesn't have any superpowers, right? He makes his own. He's the engineer superhero. So And he's got a gestural interface too, eventually. And so the kind of contrast between Minority Report and Tony Stark's stuff is telling in a way, right? In Minority Report, we're saying, well, this is the technology that the world has. For Iron Man, we're saying, well, this is technology that Tony has designed just for himself to use. He doesn't have to care if anyone else could use it. So there's license in a way to be a little more idiosyncratic with it and maybe even to be a little more technical, right? He doesn't have the sort of Cupertino Apple, well, it's got to be a one button push or nobody's going to buy the next iPhone kind of thing. It can be as sort of sophisticated as it needs to be, which is a nice other direction to take as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mark Zuckerberg, one of his New Year's resolutions was to create his own Jarvis. That was 2 years ago. Did he call you for
what
advice?
What would he do with Zach Jarvis?
That was a good, no, I think
he didn't.
He was going to organize. I think control his home. But that was the halcyon days of 2016.
Yes,
before he was being blamed.
Many things have changed.
Yeah, that was before he's.
You know,
being
his home
for
is probably fine.
Yeah, it probably is. Yeah. So, what other films have you worked on?
You know, another one that's sort of personally meaningful for me is Aeon Flux. It's a kind of malign film, and it had a very, very difficult birth. But its director Karin Kusama is really extraordinary. You go back to her first film, Girl Fight, and you can see a lot of stuff happening there. And more recently, she made a thing called The Invitation, which is one of the smartest and creepiest kind of psychological horror films I've seen in decades. Everyone should check it out. But there's an absolutely great film lurking inside Aeon Flux, which is still a fascinating and very, very good film. But Studio Cold Feet. It's kind of a, you know, typical Hollywood horror story.
So when you watch something and they get holograms or other technology horribly wrong, what do you do?
You know, I used to grimace. I used to clutch my head dramatically. But there's no time to do that anymore because I have a real job building that stuff in the real world and making sure that it works, that it doesn't induce head clutching in actual people who have to use the actual tech. And that's ultimately a really, really satisfying occupation.
So we're talking about Oblong Industries. Yep. That's the company that you founded, and your product is Mezzanine, mm-hmm. which is a conferencing system, right? But not your grandpa's video conferencing system.
Not your grandpa's video conferencing system, yeah.
Let's talk about when you started Oblong and what compelled you to start the company.
Well, Oblong was ultimately a kind of straight line that started at MIT in the Media Lab work and moved directly through Minority Report. And it was the third take on those same ideas, the idea that a new kind of UI, a more powerful UI, a more capable UI, a more human-centric UI would actually let people do new things, not just do things faster or better, but actually let people do things they couldn't do any other way. And in fact, that was, if I had a single message in the Minority Report work, that was it. There's no AI in that mm-hmm. film, right? What I was saying is that this new UI lets these already hugely capable detectives, Tom Cruise, the John Anderson character, and his team, do something time critical that they couldn't do without the UI. They're already great detectives, but they've got 6 minutes now to sift through an enormous mountain of images and little video sequences to figure out, you know, who, what, when, where, not why, but it doesn't matter, like, in time to stop the crime. And it's uncorrelated data. And so what we're saying there is that with this UI, you know, you're not going to use a mouse to make sense of what the precogs have kind of burped up. You've got to use this super powerful UI that exists in a big visual context. You need lots and lots of pixels just to spread everything out, put it together, use your own amazing human wetware to make sense of it. And that is, in fact, what Mezzanine is. It is very literally a translation of that Minority Report system, more for daily work and business use cases than it is for saving people's lives, but you never know.
Some of your customers are like NASA, so perhaps you have saved some lives.
Well,
Who are some other customers that have used?
NASA, Accenture, IBM. There's a really interesting construction company called Holder. They do very, very sophisticated, difficult projects. And the idea that you can use a collaborative system, and that's the C word, collaboration, is really what mezzanine makes possible, that you need that level of kind of, again, high fidelity, high bandwidth collaboration between people, among people, and also their data, their applications, their stuff, to make decisions, to kind of push the work product further. And current technologies don't cut it. Like, you know, you're not going to build this fantastically complex building in the time that's allotted if you're emailing back and forth. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of what we're left with. Otherwise, what we have today is kind of a hodgepodge of video conferencing, which is fantastic. You know, high fidelity pixels lets us talk almost as if we were in the same room together. Mm-hmm. But that's not the work. What about the CAD model? What about the BIM system that's, you know, simulating the HVAC on the hottest day of the year, the coldest day of the year? You need to see all of that stuff at the same time. So you need a huge pixel array like Minority Report, and you need enough space and a UI that expects that multiple people are going to use it at the same time, like Minority Report. And all of that taken together, including the idea that some people will be remote in a different mezzanine room that's kind of seamed together with the first room, so that it doesn't matter where you're injecting data from or applications from. Everyone sees the same thing. All of that solves a big chunk of work problems that you really can't get at, I think, in any other way.
Well, I mean, we've wanted this for so long, and, you know, there's collaboration, of course. Like, you know, I can send a Google Doc to someone. Yep. They've figured out that we can both work on it at the same time. We're not going to mess up our, you know, our edits that we hit.
And that's brilliant stuff. Like, like multiple cursors, that's really, really great. But in Office 365 or the Google Suite, you have a word processor, you've got a spreadsheet, and you've got slides.
And it doesn't assume that we're together in a room working on it. It assumes that you're in LA and I'm in Petaluma.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that was the core question that drove, you know, that animated the Media Lab stuff, Minority Report, and Mezzanine. Like, start with the room. What do we need to do as professionals, as colleagues, in a room under kind of in professional circumstances? What would we do without a computer? And then how do we build a collaborative computer that lets us do that, you know, with all of the amplification that the digital world makes available?
Well, because we got so, interested in the idea that, you know, I can be living in Hong Kong and be, you know, communicating and working with you across the world, that... And now so many people use those when I'm down the hall. Like, you know, we have a very tiny office here. And how many times does, you know, someone use one of our many communication tools to contact me instead of shouting or coming down the hall?
That's right.
And, I mean,
and that's telling, and that's appropriate too, whether it's chat, Slack or something else. And sometimes that escalates to video, even if you're down the hall. We've found that in our own studies. That's there's a lot to learn from the idea that, you know, sometimes it's better not to take the 30 seconds to get up from your desk.
Right.
Like, just the instantaneity of that kind of video connection is important. But then, you know, square that, take it further, and have it not just be video of faces.
Right. And, yeah. And so, I mean, if you look out in our hallway, we have a big production calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And then for one of our big shows, for the Screensavers, we have another production calendar. And I find myself looking at those so often, even though all the same information is in a Google calendar and I can open it up. But just to be able to see it, and especially if I want to, you know, move something around or talk to someone, you know, then we can look at it together. And that, I don't know if that sort of conferencing on the big screen is really, the way we work, it would help in that way. But I think I need it for my kitchen, for my family.
I think so too. I want mezzanine in my own house.
Yes. And yeah. I have three kids. We'll everybody's going. Yeah. So everyone has opinion on everything that we're doing. So,
show me the calendar. Show me your pictures.
Yes.
Show me the video you're editing.
Exactly.
You know, show me your homework.
Yes. Yeah. Because I find my kids do AirPlay their keynotes to the Apple TV and show me them, you know, and so it is, I guess we have
and that's great. So that's one piece, the kind of recognition or the revelation is to say, well, what if you and I both need to look at something?
Yeah.
You know, you're contributing something, I'm contributing something. The value occurs when they're side by side and we sort of see the juxtaposition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of the thing that happens when you go from one to many is that, you know, that's the Cambrian explosion.
Yeah. So yeah, I can see how when people are collaborating on big projects with lots of moving parts and lots of people in different places, that can be really useful.
Yeah.
So that's the one product is Mezzanine.
Yeah, that's our flagship product, and it's available in all sorts of sizes for different kinds of work environments. But it's all interoperable, which is really fun, right? You can join these single screen or two screen versions together with a room that might have 18 screens, and people can just sort of put the stuff they need into that visual space and see it together.
So if a company has it, do the employees, like, can someone run it on their iPhone if they're, you know, just... Is it web-based or is it an app?
There's a browser client for it as well. The core, the native, as we say, the native interface is not web or browser technology based, but that's sort of an implementation detail. But there is a browser client for it. And part of our thesis was that we're not out to replace the technology, the devices that people have. On the contrary, they're incredibly useful. Your laptop or your tablet, whatever your device of choice is, or your smartphone, is your kind of second self. You carry it around like that. The key is getting the stuff out of there into a space where other people can see it. So I kind of think of it as the missing half of computers, the missing half of computation. The implication was always there, and it just needed to be built. So this is the computer for multiple people to use at the same time, the collaborative computer. But part of the recognition, and I interrupted myself there and got way off track, part of the recognition was we don't want to replace those devices. We want to embrace them. So we've got to kind of bring whatever you've got philosophy, and we do the hard tech work to back it up. So whether it's a smartphone or a tablet or a browser or a laptop with a native client, all forms are welcome, and everything that you have can flow into this big conversation.
So whenever I use conferencing software that gives me the ability to share my screen, I get a little bit nervous.
Like, yes, we,
like,
all do.
Yeah.
What notifications will come up?
Yes.
What email is on display? Did I forget that I'm, that I'm projecting pixels into a, you know, more publicly visible space?
Right.
Exactly.
So, is there a possibility of that happening with the Mezzanine?
There certainly is, and this is, you know, part of what's so fun is that the doors are blown off the barn now, and what we're saying is let's not worry about that and shut things down as a result of something that could go wrong. Let's recognize that there's huge value in getting this right, and now let's build the missing pieces of UI that let us do that. So, for example, the world doesn't have visual pieces of UI right now that distinguish between... pixels that are purely private and pixels that might be shared into a larger space. But we need that language, right? So it's about inventing a new kind of literacy, a new kind of vocabulary and syntax and grammar that's going to let people interact, in a digital space as kind of fluently and fluidly and adaptively as we do in social situations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really fun.
So I know your TED Talk is about, like, sort of the fact that there's only really one UI, and it's been around forever, and we don't have a new one.
Right.
Is creating a new UI still part of the mission?
It is. It's interesting because the TED Talk happened right at the cusp, right before we had finished the product and sent it out into the world commercially. So it's sort of the end of the setup era of Oblong when we're developing the Minority Report operating system, as we think of it. GSpeak is the software platform that Mezzanine and all our other stuff is built on. But we didn't quite, at the time of the TED Talk, have the experience with a kind of, widespread commercial product to say things as clearly as we would say them now. So it's a nice thumbtack at a particular point on the calendar. It is inventing new UI is still absolutely the mission. But I think the difference between the TED days and now is that, if you and I had been talking back in 2010 at the time of TED, I would have said Oblong's mission and the world's necessity is to leave behind the old UI and build a new one. Ditch the devices, the computers that we've had for the last 20 years or whatever it is, and build what's next. And I think that's incorrect. I think what we need to do, and this is very much what Mezzanine does today and Oblong aims at today, is to augment these very, very capable and adequate interfaces that are designed for one person at a time, augment them with UI that lets them kind of join together in a shared space, in a collaborative space, in a space where it's, you know, it's a conversation rather than a monologue. So it's kind of an additive thing rather than a replacement proposition.
So in the TED Talk, you see you and then the other people we just saw using the Tom Cruise gloves.
Yep.
But
yep.
In the mezzanine video we saw, there are no gloves.
There are no gloves in mezzanine.
So you don't currently. Get to use the gloves.
You don't get to use the gloves. It was a decision we had to make, a product design decision early on. Like, are we going to ship with gloves? And we started thinking about it, and, you know, you get sweaty inside gloves. And if there's only three pairs of gloves, I don't know, you know, if mezzanine comes with N pairs of gloves,
right,
and an N plus one person comes into the room, I don't really want to peel them off and hand them to you. It's just, you know, there's something a little bit wrong with that.
Eye-to-eye contact is fine. Glove to hand sweat to hand sweat contact.
But it's more than that. So that it's not just the hygiene aspect. There's some important kind of social signaling that is the difference between bare hand or gloved hand control, gestural control, and control that you get through a gestural interface that uses a different artifact, like the wand, which is what mezzanine does ship with. So, for example, if the wand is sitting here and you pick it up, that's a cue, a sort of subliminal cue to everyone who's in the room that something's about to happen. You're going to make a point. You're going to change our view of what we're seeing. Or the moment when you hand the wand across to me is a kind of transition point in the digital conversation. So there's a lot of great stuff that you kind of get for free when you have a physical artifact. Also, the fact that you can't take your hands off and put them down, but you can put the wand down.
Right. So is there one wand, or there's more than one wand?
Most larger mezzanine systems ship with multiple wands, mm-hmm. right? So again, that, you know, building a UI that lets multiple people at the same time change the system, interact with the system without the whole thing exploding, was a technical challenge and an absolutely euphoric one to overcome, right? We need a digital world that works the same way the physical world does. Like, I can pick up a coffee cup, you can pick up a whiteboard pen, and the world doesn't explode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see. I mean, because everyone gets, so tired of PowerPoint presentations. Like, they're exhausting. I just feel, you know, sometimes I'll go to an event that my kid's school is putting on, and, you know, they're just showing me a PowerPoint presentation. Yeah. And I'm like, this is wasting my time. I could have just watched that at home. And I'm not saying, like, we could all interact with it, but I think... Yeah. I would look forward to a time where there was more interaction rather than just one person presenting something. I feel like it could democratize a lot of interactions in the workplace.
I think democratization or democracy is a great word and one worth thinking about. It sometimes feels uncomfortable, I don't know why, in a kind of commercial context, but democratizing a business process, making it participatory rather than, you know, as you say, the stultifying PowerPoint monologue is really, really transformative.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires business practice, business pattern transformation as well, right? We have to sort of un-single thread a lot of business practices to get to something that's much more useful and, frankly, a lot more fun. But the good news there is that people know how to do that inherently. Like, we just have to unlearn some bad habits about the idea that it's one thing at a time, it's just my laptop plugged in with my awful slides, you know, and no matter what you might have to say, it's too bad because I own the pixels until you grab the HDMI cable away from me. So going from that to the thing where, it's your stuff and my stuff and her ideas and our remote colleagues' ideas all jostling together, that's like real life, and we're already good at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about Sheryl Sandberg. I mean, people have different feelings about her, but one of her things in her Lean In book was take a seat at the table. Like, if you're given, sit at the conference table, women often sit around and let all the men sit at the top. But it's like, take the wand.
Take the wand. Exactly. So, and engage.
Yeah.
Allowing everyone. It's not saying that everyone has to talk at the same time. It's not a Robert Altman film, right? but anyone could. And that's the big difference. That's what changes, I think, is that at whatever moment when it's really important for you to inject a much better idea, you can.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep it from becoming a Robert Altman film?
It was something that we got asked constantly at the very beginning when we said, you get two wands, three wands, whatever it is, right? People would freak out and be like, well, what happened? Wait, two wands, what if I grab something while she's grabbing another thing? Like, well, it's fine. Like, you know, if you happen to grab the same book at the same time in the physical world, social cues take over, you know, or even talking. Like, if if our verbiage collides, I say, oh, sorry, please go ahead, right? Mm-hmm. You know, all of the social machinery is already in place to solve those problems. So what we made a very, you know, it was an important decision to say, no, we will not have a kind of pass the ball thing. We will let multiple things happen at the same time. And we're trusting that people's basic instincts will solve it. We don't have to solve it in a kind of computer science way. The human biology and our desire to be kind of good actors and complicit in a kind of social interaction will rule the day, and it does.
So any sort of toxic workplace stuff that someone
will also manifest inside messaging.
You can't. Right? You're like, not solving the toxic.
If you're just
workplace.
Constantly fighting and you know sniping at people, that'll show up in the UI, which is kind of cool.
People start hitting each other over the head with the wands.
We'll need to offer a plush version of the wand for those environments.
So I want to ask you about technology that's out there a little bit. I know that, I mean, we tend to think of the Minority Report gesturing as virtual reality or augmented mm-hmm. reality, but it's really not, as you said. But what do you think about, HoloLens as it stands now?
My feeling about HoloLens is that it is very analogous to the Apple II Plus, right? Or the Atari 1600 or whatever was the, you know, your little personal computer back in the day, right? It's that moment when all of it, you know, you don't have a supercomputer, but you have enough of a computer so that people who are really motivated can go and invent, you know, the electronic spreadsheet. Or Bill Budge invented, you know, all sorts of new kinds of gaming principles and so forth. And that's the reason that's possible is because of access, right? Mm-hmm. Suddenly computation becomes something that lots of people have access to, and you can stay up all night snorting crystal meth if you want and just code for 5 days straight, and stuff happens in that mode that doesn't happen when you only get an hour of computing time. I think HoloLens is the same thing. Yeah, it could have a larger field of view. It could do all sorts of things, but it's enough right now. And so I hope people are out there inventing the analog of Choplifter or, you know, VisiCalc for that new world.
Right? And what about Leap?
Leap Motion.
Leap Motion. And
magically.
So Leap Motion is the leaps, that you yes. do a lot of hand yep. gesture technology. What are your thoughts on them?
Well, it's great. I mean, that's an enabling technology. It's the analog maybe of something like Logitech, where, you know, just make it so that gesture is always an option. Mm-hmm. And the Leap Motion stuff has come a very long way. It's really, really very impressive. So, but it's just an enabling technology, and it's like giving everyone a mouse in 1982 when all you have is the command line and saying, there you go. Mm-hmm. Well, it takes more than the device. It takes, in fact, a UI, an operating system and a GUI written around the mouse, which mm-hmm. is what the Macintosh did to really make the promise of that style of interaction into a reality. So we need that. It isn't there yet. Like, what's the universal gestural language? What's the way in which a gestural language fits in with more traditional UI? Because it's not going to be gesture for everything. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be voice for everything. I think that's one of the exciting things about the future of UI, is that we'll go from this accidental historical mono mode into a kind of multiplicity, a gorgeous harmonious riot of different modalities, different instruments in the orchestra.
And have you spent any time in VR, like in a community, at any of the places that you can hang out with other people?
I haven't. They don't mostly let me out of oblong to do things like that. So. Have you?
I have, and now I can't remember what it's called, but they almost went out of business and they got a lot less funding, but it's something VR and I can't remember, but okay. It was odd. You know, we sat around a campfire. Like there was someone that was a bee and that was, you know, you could be any shape or person that you wanted to be.
So it was a participatory experience.
Yeah,
there were multiple people who were live represented. That's
right.
Cool.
And so, like I used a headset and it was, I mean, it was interesting. And there were a lot of people that really spent a lot of time in this community. Mm-hmm. And when it almost went out of business, they were, you know, very sad. They raised the money to bring it back. So it is sort of like Second Life, but more real, I think, for some people. Yeah. But
I mean, as I said earlier, I think we're still figuring out, the job is still to figure out what it's good for. What do we really want to do in there?
Right.
There's certain to be really compelling answers. We just haven't quite gotten there yet. But I think one For me personally, one of the answers has to be, well, go work on something that's domain specific and really hard, really sophisticated. Like, if you can build a UI that's appropriate for flying a 747, that's that complex, even though that's not what everyone's going to use it for every day, you're going to learn things, the kind of clues and cues that come out of those high precision and very esoteric, frankly, interactions are pieces that you're going to need for the more general case.
Okay, so my kids will be out of the house in about 4 years, so by then we'll have a mezzanine for the home so they can mezzanine. And what else are you working on besides the mezzanine for the home for me?
Well, I mean, I think the elaboration of mezzanine is where we want to go at Oblong, and really it's straight back to the beginning of the Media Lab and Negroponte's recognition that computers are actually not about computation, they're about communication. Mm-hmm. And so if we put mezzanine everywhere, I think what you get is a kind of ubiquitous and always on collaborative mode. So if the tablet that you use today or the laptop you use today retains all of the great properties that it has, it can give you a one person at a time interface when you need to work on stuff. But at the drop of a pin or a hat or whatever it is that you drop, you can be connected to your kids, connected to a colleague in a kind of high fidelity and high bandwidth way to do something new, to make something new. That'll be transformative. That'll feel like, you know, getting a flying car, basically.
Yeah, I don't want a flying car. Just a self-driving car would be fine. Well, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time, for flying up here to talk to us. I just feel like my mind's blown a little bit. I didn't even know that I needed that kind of collaboration, but it was. I look forward to it in the
world. I think the world does need that kind of collaboration.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much, John Underkoffer. Koffler. Or Unterkoffler, if you're in touch with your roots. He is the CEO of Oblong Industries and the founder. And oblong.com is the best place for people to check it out and see if it's right for you. Or just learn more about the technology behind it. It's fascinating. Thank you so much
for
joining us.
It's been a blast.
And thank you for joining us on Triangulation. Triangulation records every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific. It's hosted by Leo Laporte, Jason Howell, and myself. And you can tune in and watch live at 3 p.m. or you can get it on any podcast catcher you want or YouTube. Thanks so much. We'll see you next week.